Welcome to M&A Access, the official podcast of the Alliance of M&A Advisors. My name is Gina Galusha, and today I am here with Wes Clark. Wes, welcome.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
I'm happy you're here, too. So we're at Summer Conference in Chicago, and Wes, you've been coming to conference for a while now.
This is my second conference here in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You started the Atlanta chapter because you came and met a bunch of people here, right?
That's right. So I was doing some work here in Chicago, met some folks connected to M&AA, was surprised to learn that you didn't have one in Atlanta. And so that was the beginning of getting the process started to set one up there, since there's, you know, a lot of good things happening in Atlanta.
Absolutely.
In the middle market. So.
It's busy.
Yeah.
It's hopping. Well, we are so glad that you came and joined us and that you're here for the podcast today.
Yeah.
So you are a man of many talents.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I would love to hear the story of how you came to acquire those various talents.
Sure.
Where'd you start in this business?
I started out, before I started in investment banking, I knocked out the CPA exam and was working here in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And knew I wanted to go into investment banking and leverage Darden, UVA's business school, to get into investment banking at UBS, and basically worked in, you know, bulge bracket investment banks,
mm-hmm.
UBS, JP Morgan, focused on healthcare for a number of years. And, you know, really liked it, learned a lot about doing medical devices, pharma, biotech, healthcare services, you know, all sorts of healthcare, M&A, healthcare capital raising transactions. And after a number of years, wanted to do something more entrepreneurial.
Mm-hmm. Before we go there, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
So one of our instructors for SEMA,
yeah.
He's from bulge bracket kind of background, and he talks about, like, as an analyst, a young analyst, they basically put him in a closet for 20 hours a day and we're like, do this work.
Yeah.
Is that what it was like?
So if when you arrive, you didn't have a good work ethic, you acquire one very quickly because...
That's a nice way to say that.
you fully work, you know, 60, 70, 80 hours a week at that time. I don't know what it's like right now, but back then, yeah, you would definitely do 80, you know, hours a week because you're super busy and they're trying to get the most out of you, of course. So.
Right.
And you want to learn as much as you could about the space that you were in. So, yeah, you worked a lot of hours.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you lived at work, so to speak.
Did you have fun at work, too?
I mean, the deals are super interesting, and so that came with
yes.
a lot of satisfaction.
Yes.
You know, and going into investment banking at a firm like that, one of the criteria is, are you the kind of person that someone would enjoy working with every day, you know, 80, 90 hours a week?
Mm-hmm.
And or if it's, you know, 1 a.m. on a Thursday or Friday night, are you the kind of person that, are you the kind of person that people can count on, right?
Right.
And so when you meet those criteria, everybody kind of, you know, has those similarities. And so you have a good time together.
Right. That makes total sense. And I think, too, when you work in a role that is highly demanding,
mm-hmm.
it character will out, you know? You'll find out who someone is pretty fast when they're sleep deprived and a little burnout and a little
right.
frazzled. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's
very true.
You'll find out if they're a good egg or need a little bit more time in the kitchen.
Yeah. No, that's a great comparison. Yeah.
Okay. So you said from there you were looking to do something more entrepreneurial.
Yes. And so a firm called CFRA, which focuses on equity research, mm-hmm. deep dives into, you know, companies, was interesting to me. And I would be taking on the healthcare role there.
Mm-hmm.
And I could see the, you know, direct links between that work and the work that I was doing in investment banking. Long story short, when it comes to a company's financial results, there are a lot of gray areas that management can work with to make the results look no better or worse than they really are.
Mm-hmm.
I saw this firsthand, you know, just it's within Gap. I saw that firsthand in working on M&A deals. And so I knew what CFRA was bringing to the table was very real. It's a small, much smaller business at that time. And so, you know, it was an opportunity to do something, you know, like I said, much more entrepreneurial.
Mm-hmm.
And I took on that role. And while in that role, I also knocked out the CFA designation, which, you know, is considered by some to be pretty challenging, but it's directly relevant to what you do at a firm like CFA at that time.
I feel as though you're really good at taking tests, because I've also heard that the CPA test is harder sometimes than the bar.
Yeah, I've heard that too. I mean, I don't know anything about the bar, but some regard the CFA as being, you know, the hardest test on Wall Street. Mm-hmm. You know, you have different thoughts about it, but I don't think it's easy. Yeah. And I think you learn a lot through the program. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Yeah, my husband's been going through the last couple of years, just this, all the series, you know, the 63 and the 7 and now he's 9 and 10. And it's a lot. It's a lot.
Yeah.
Sometimes we'll go out walks at night and he'll tell me what he's learned and I pretend like I understood. It's good review for him, I think. But yeah, it's a lot of information you got to acquire.
Yeah, a lot of content.
That's impressive. Okay. And then you made another shift from there. Tell us.
Yeah, so I did that covering U.S. healthcare companies and then was asked to help grow our Asia business at that time. There had been an effort to achieve that previously hadn't worked out, and taking on the role, also with a business development partner, you know, we had a solid success growing the practice in Hong Kong, Singapore, and so there's a lot of travel, which I definitely enjoy, but also learning a ton about companies listed outside the United States, and so, you know, it was a great time. I did that for a total of eight years.
Oh, wow. So, that's a lot of travel. Yeah. Which country do you enjoy most in terms of their environment for business and business growth from all those ones you were in?
Environment for business and business growth. So for me, at the end of the day, while there's, you know, a ton of quantitative stuff involved with doing business, it really comes down to the people. And I had a great experience in both Hong Kong and Singapore. I think Singapore wins out a little bit more, though. You know, people are really, you know, definitely really smart, but also, you know, very, very personable, and, you know, felt like they're very down to earth, and so felt like I connected well.
That's cool.
In Singapore.
I've heard the food there is amazing.
Yeah, it's tons of great food, and while a lot of people talk about it, it gets super hot. You can move around very well underground there.
Oh.
Yeah, so you're never really exposed to all
like
the heat.
A tunneler.
Yeah, they have tunnels. A
lot interesting.
Yeah, mall shops underground, yeah.
I didn't know that. That's so smart. So smart. So do you speak the languages?
No, I don't speak either language. Fortunately, they speak English very well. So, yeah.
So you just learned how to tunnel.
That's right. I learned how to tunnel.
It's an important skill, I guess.
Yeah. How to get around is really important.
If the apocalypse comes,
yeah,
I'll follow you.
Okay, good. I'll lead you.
Thank you. I'll take it. Okay, so from there, where'd you go?
So post-CFRA, I wanted to do something, you know, I did for 8 years. I was interested in doing something else. Long story short, they'd gone to like a couple of acquisitions while I was there.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, they had gone through another acquisition. And so I thought, well, you know, I really did like M&A in its many forms and returned to investment banking.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where you are now?
Correct.
All right. So with your investment banking practice right now, how much of your work is investment banking?
It's majority investment banking.
Okay.
So
buy, sell side?
It's sell side and buy side, more sell side than buy side. And I've done some CFO services work because when you work with small and mid-sized businesses, you know, a lot of times documentation, a lot of things that you want to have a successful M&A transaction isn't present yet.
Mm-hmm.
And so whether it's M&A or capital raising, you need to have certain things in place. And so I took on that role to help, you know, help businesses kind of get it together so they can, you know, raise the capital that they seek and, you know, show up with their act together.
Okay.
You know.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
What do you find most interesting when you start to dig into a company's books when they need that kind of support? Is it kind of fun to find the areas of opportunity and fix them? Is that what you dig about it? Or is it more like the mystery of a new set of books?
For me, I mean, the books are kind of like a puzzle, mm-hmm, right?
Mm-hmm. And I hear what you're like going. It's looking into someone else's brain sometimes, you know?
Well, in a sense it is, and at the same time, I always feel like a bigger question is, do the books actually reflect what's been happening in the business, right? Mm-hmm. Because one of the challenges that, you know, mid-sized, small businesses face is they may have a CPA firm that has been helping them with the numbers and whatnot, but the books don't really convey the reality of what's happening within the organization. Mm-hmm. And so as someone who is a huge advocate of the success of small, mid-sized businesses, that the absence of the financials actually reflecting what's going on makes it far harder for management of the company mm-hmm. to be successful, mm-hmm. right? Because you're taking where you are now, extrapolating forward and, you know, trying to use that as a part of getting to the goal or vision you have for your organization. Mm-hmm. And so that if the foundation is wrong, then it's going to be hard to hit the future goals that you have
that
for your organization.
Yeah, that makes total sense. So kind of taking a false narrative in the books and mm-hmm. making it a narrative that is more accurate and strategic.
Right. It's more accurate and strategic. Something that you can take and say, all right, well, you know, this quarter we did X and we thought we were going to do Y. Mm-hmm. And because the numbers are reliable, you can more successfully figure out what caused you to not hit what you expected
right.
to achieve.
Yeah. Right, yeah.
And so you can adjust your trajectory mm-hmm. In terms of time or what you need to do to hit the goal or strategy right. that you have for your organization.
Right, and what's working and what's winning and how to expand on that.
What's working, what's winning, what's not working. Yeah.
Yeah. That's so fun.
It's fun. It's cool. It's important. Definitely important to the businesses. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So you do sell side mostly, some buy side, and then a little CFO.
Yep.
And then any wealth advising too?
None at all.
Okay.
No.
So does that, as
a hobby, I like staying on top of the market.
Mm-hmm. It's a fun week for the market this week.
Yeah. There's seemingly a lot of selling going so that people can raise capital in preparation for the SpaceX IPO. Mm-hmm. And, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of index funds have to be 100% invested. And so they have to sell something before they can buy something.
Right.
And that can cause downward pressure,
yep.
which is part of like what we're seeing right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my husband's quite busy. And almost all of that busyness is folks who are clearing the decks so they can buy SpaceX.
Yeah.
Okay, so, but I would say that, well, I would guess, mm-hmm. tell me if I'm wrong, that financial advising background for the sell side is probably really helpful when you're thinking about preparing them, because every financial advisor I talk to, they say that they really want to be involved in the system before the sale happens, before the LOI happens, right? So that the seller can keep as much as possible. Mm. So does that help when you're doing the sell side advising to have that background?
It definitely does, because when you have a seller, generally, they want to get the most from their business, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like,
mm-hmm.
you know, other things can matter, legacy, whatnot can matter to a seller. But typically, they want to get as much as they can for their business. And so if you have an appreciation for what's happening in the market in a broader sense, and in my case, more for like healthcare multiples, because the publicly traded multiples do play a role in the multiples that small, mid-sized businesses receive, the higher the multiples are, for public companies, you know, the higher the multiple you're likely to get for small, mid-sized companies, because they are related, it helps to have perspective on a broader scale that's relevant to a particular seller.
Okay.
Yeah,
I can see it. I can see it. Yeah. You, like I said, man of many talents. So when you, how do those skills that you've acquired help when you work on the buy side?
The way they help on the buy side is they help in so many ways. Let's see. So, you know, when you're looking to buy a business, you want the thing that appears to be a certain way to actually be that way. Mm. And
that's such a good definition. It's a great distilling. Keep going.
So you know, if you believe that it was throwing off $100 million of revenue and, you know, $10 million in profit, and then when you drill down on the numbers, you see, you know, different types of financial shenanigans present, then you know it's not really the 100 and the 10. And so my background from an equity research standpoint at CFRA, which, like I said, included a meaningful forensic analysis element to it, becomes really useful for buyers. And so knowing that is super useful to not overpay for a business, but also, you know, where can the synergies be realized and whatnot.
So, yeah. Okay. All right. What's your favorite part?
My favorite part of M&A or?
Yeah. Your favorite part of M&A, and if you have a story that exemplifies that,
sure.
We'd love to hear that.
So my favorite part is when you successfully close a transaction. And
is it the champagne?
Closing dinners are fantastic. Yeah. And so when, like, one of the first deals I worked on was a healthcare company in the PBM space and pharmacy benefit manager space. And so what makes it special, one of my first deals, but also they had gone through a process previously and it didn't work out. So it's kind of like they were turned down, right? And so they were, some call it a retrade. And so the, you know, the CFO, CEO of this company were very animated about not having the same type of experience, right? And so, you know, working with them, making the changes that needed to occur, and ultimately getting across the finish line, you saw, you know, two totally different people. I mean, extremely happy with having successfully sold the company. And so that was one of my first and favorite deals because you helped them do something that they previously failed to do.
Yeah.
And you know, they'd learned a lot through that initial failure. And so it's great to be a part of, you know, getting them on the path that would make them a success in that second attempt.
Okay. Yeah. I was talking to Nick Phillips. Do you know Nick Phillips from Big Scopered the other day on the podcast?
Nope.
Okay. Well, you should meet him.
Okay.
You two would hit it off. And he was talking about that's one of his favorite things is when the company goes through a failed transaction and learns and grows and becomes stronger and better for it and getting to watch that process. So. That's interesting that you both kind of are on that page. So that's why I think you should be friends. I'll introduce you at the closing reception. Okay. So, okay. Let's see. When you're working on the sell side with growth strategy, where do you start?
If I'm on the sell side with a growth strategy, so it's a company that's growing very well and they are for sale. Okay. So a high growth company that's up for sale, the starting point is just getting understanding of what the owner, what management's ultimate goal is, right? And you know, how do they see things? How do they feel about things? What's their current view of what the business is worth? That is, you know, the key starting point. And another part of that is figuring out, do they really want to sell? You know, because when you've built something and it's growing very quickly right now, and a lot of times that's not the moment that an owner wants to sell, right? And so I think you want to wrap your arms around what's driving their interest in selling at that point. It could be that, you know, they feel that the business is hitting a point in the business life cycle where they're not the best, you know, operator for this increased level of success. And so they're looking to sell at that point. Could be life factors, you know, they want to, they're older, they want to retire, you know, it could be a lot of things, it could be divorce. There's so many catalysts for a business being sold So I'd want to get my hands around what's happening with the owner that's driving their interest in selling the business at that point. Mm-hmm. I think that's the key area to begin.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So say that it is divorce.
Okay.
Which I always find, you know, when I first heard that, when I was taking the SEMA class, I was like, oh my gosh, that's so sad. I've never thought about that before. Yeah. You know, that's involved too, because there's so much that's already fraught, you know, in that whole situation. But how do you approach it differently if it's divorce? Do you?
Well, it's heavily grounded, you know, in real life. And so the seller has to consider, he has to consider that in selling it, he may not get, you know, the whole value of the company, right? He's going to have to share it. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that's the case if his partner is an owner in the business, right? So, you know, so that's something that has to be considered. It also requires emotional, psychological alignment between the two parties about what will happen to the business, because he may be thinking sale, you know, she could be, or, you know, whoever his spouse is could be thinking something else. So there has to be a meeting with the mind there before you can really move forward on a transaction.
That makes total sense.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I mean, if there are kids involved and the kids have a stake in a business, like, there has to be family alignment, family agreement about what is going to happen before you can truly move forward.
So when did you get your degree in family therapy?
I didn't. I did not get my degree in family therapy. I did get a master practitioner certification in neuro-linguistic programming, which is an important part of, you know, hearing what the other person is saying, and, you know, their conversational and, you know, communication modalities, and, you know, matching, pacing, leading, mirroring the other person to help, you know, truly understand and empathize with where that person is. And I think that helps you to grasp what's happening with the person that you're talking to.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's genius. What other designations do you have hidden in your back pocket? Any others that you were like, I need this skill, I'm gonna go get it?
Other designations? No. I mean, I have a double master's from Weill Cornell, Weill Cornell Graduate School, the Weill Cornell School of Medicine, and Cornell Johnson School of Business. It's MS in Healthcare Policy, Leadership, and Administration. And the master's part is focused on finance and healthcare. So,
are you a school junkie?
Am I a school junkie? No. I do love learning things. And that's one of the things I like about working with businesses. Like, even if you have two businesses that are, you know, same industry, you know, same size, they may rhyme, but they're still very unique. You know, the story behind them is very different. The owners are going to be different. Their journeys in life are very different. Mm-hmm. So just learning a lot of, you know, learning new things, learning how things work, I find that to be very rewarding.
Yeah.
And it keeps this profession fresh.
It's very Aristotelian of you, if you think about it. Mm. Understanding how things work and why they work, and then go and do something with it, you know?
Okay. Thank you.
When it comes to growth strategies and a capital raise, kind of, you know, that other scenario of we are growing, but we need more to grow in the way we want to grow.
Mm-hmm.
How do you approach that strategy?
The starting point is, they want to raise capital, what is a strategy that they're going to use to generate a return on the capital in excess of what it costs, right? And, you know, that can take many forms. It could be a new product, could be, you know, a new manufacturing facility, you know, new locations. And it also matters what industry that they're in. Some industries are, you know, super competitive, others are less competitive, some are like super fragmented. So, you know, the growth plan could be, I don't know, buying another business, right? So there's so many ways that a business can grow. So understanding what their strategy is and how long it will take to get a return on investment. So what kind of returns they expect, but also how long it's going to take, because you want to match the capital you raise with the duration of when the strategy is going to start paying off.
Right.
So
yes.
you don't want to take out like a 3-year loan and the strategy is not going to pay off for 4 or 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you won't have the cash flow from realizing the strategy to service the debt. So you want alignment between the strategy and the duration of the capital that you raise, but also the type of capital that you raise.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you want to retain ownership, then, you know, you don't want to raise a lot of equity that's more than, you know, 50% of the value of the business. So.
Right, for sure. When you are doing those projections mm-hmm. of the strategy for paying that debt back and making the money you need to make as well, mm-hmm. do you typically lowball it just in case something goes awry, or do you try to hit it the target dead on, or how do you think about it that way?
So the common approach, an approach I like, is to have kind of three lenses that you look at it through, right? One is, you know, far more optimistic, right? You might call it the bull case, right? A base case and then a downside case. And I think you do want to be very conservative and mm-hmm. kind of lean towards the downside to base case more and deciding what the right amount of capital that you can afford is.
Mm-hmm.
But related to that is, you know, who are you going to get the capital from? Like, you want a capital provider who you're comfortable with, because we were talking about a divorce earlier, right? So a lot of times the length of a relationship between a company and a capital provider, you know, it's a number of years.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times it's longer than, you know, the average marriage, right? And so...
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
What is that statistic?
Well, you can be connected for well over 5 years. Let's just say that.
Okay.
And so it means you want a capital provider who you have a great relationship with, right? You can have a great relationship with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're thinking long-term. They're thinking long-term. And... in addition to that, they know your space, right? They understand your industry, so that if it's like debt, then the covenants and whatnot, positive and negative covenants, are structured in a way whereby they're not too restrictive for your industry. So
mm-hmm.
if things, you know, come out towards the downside and you are close to tripping, or if you like somehow trip, better yet, you don't trip any covenants, right? Because it's structured in a way that conveys understanding of your business, your industry.
Okay.
So.
No, that makes sense. You want a partner, right?
Right. You want a partner.
You don't want a master.
No.
You want a partner. From the capital provider's perspective,
yeah.
what are they sometimes looking for that the owner operators don't even think to consider?
The capital provider might be thinking about something like owner dependence, and the owner wouldn't be thinking about this so much. Owner dependence, where the success of the business is highly dependent on that owner's relationship
mm-hmm.
with customers. So if something were to happen to that owner, the business would essentially decline markedly.
Right.
Yeah.
Another
thing is customer concentration.
Always.
Yeah. Small, mid-sized businesses, decent chance you might have one major customer or,
mm-hmm.
you know, a few customers that represent a huge percentage of your business. So customer concentration is a third thing.
So very similar to like a buyer perspective in a lot of
it
ways.
It definitely is similar to a buyer.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, there are a number of things that the capital providers or a buyer will be thinking about that a business owner might not be thinking about.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Because they think they're the asset, right? Because they built it, and it's their victory.
Yeah.
You know, it makes sense.
Yeah. And they are. They are a
Absolutely.
Key asset. They made it happen. Their
yeah.
blood, their sweat, their tears, their
mm-hmm.
sacrificing,
mm-hmm.
you know, missing, you know, school plays for the kids, shortening vacations, skipping vacations. So, yeah. Which entrepreneurs often have to sacrifice
right.
in order to get the business to where they want it to be.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true. From the buyer perspective, since
okay.
we're on that train, and we're talking about perspectives and how they don't necessarily see each other's perspectives. Mm. What does a buyer sometimes miss or misunderstand about the seller and about the business owner?
Mm. A lot of times the buyers are serial buyers. And so, you know, they've done many acquisitions. They're a part of a, you know, much bigger organization. Their mindset is different. You know, a lot of times folks may call it like, you know, they're professional managers, not in the sense of like the business owner is not a professional. Mm-hmm. They definitely are. It's just, it's a mindset of more so detached from the business, mm-hmm. and their personal wealth is diversified into other things, whereas the business owner's wealth is often highly tied in their business. And so the, you know, the buyers have that different, you know, they try to be more objective as opposed to having a more subjective mindset. And so they don't necessarily connect with the business owner because they are, their psychology is different at that point. And also the buyers may not have been an entrepreneur at some point, so they don't know the entrepreneur's journey that the business owner went through to get to where he or she is at that point.
Right.
So it's harder for them to connect in that way. And that's where an advisor actually comes in to play, to help bridge the gap between the two.
Right. That makes total sense because it's a very different personality that goes out into the wilderness and creates a business, mm-hmm. you know, with their bare hands, mm-hmm. versus someone who, you know, gets an investor and takes and builds and those kinds of things. It's a very different personality, right?
Yeah. Very much.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, one is far more risk taking, mm-hmm. right? This is what you had to be to succeed as an entrepreneur.
Right.
And the other one is, tends to be much more conservative. It's more of the mindset that the buyer is approaching the business owner with. So, mm-hmm.
I can see how a business owner, too, is like, yes, you should take a risk on my business. It's amazing. I built it. What's your problem? You know?
Yeah. Yeah, you're spot on. And that may be said without having everything in place to evidence that what is being said is, in fact, you know, true or, you know, highly verifiable.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that is much more of an entrepreneur's mindset relative to the buyer who wants to see everything documented and supported. So,
right. Yeah. Right. Okay. All right. This has been a fun chat. We're not done yet, but I'm just going to throw that out there because it is. let's see. We talked a lot about the human side of M&A. What aspects of the human side of it have we missed?
What parts haven't we talked about? You know, it's a pretty intense journey for the business owner. And it starts out that way. It ends that way. And that just speaks to how it's super helpful to start the process earlier. Because the potentially disruptive part of doing an M&A transaction, you want that to be minimized. And so by starting early in the process, you know, mm-hmm. like a year out, that can be avoided. So you don't have any weakness in the performance of the core business because a business owner and a management team was distracted by the M&A transaction. So,
right.
Yeah.
Right. Yep. That makes sense. And I think too, like, how often do they come to you and say, I want to sell my business, and they think it's going to be like selling a house and it'll take like a, you know, a month of cleanup and a couple contractors and then sayonara.
Yeah, that definitely happens a lot. You know, oftentimes when you're a business owner, you're accustomed to making demands and those demands are met very quickly.
Mm.
And it has a lot, selling a business has a lot of similarities to selling a house, right? But it typically takes a lot longer. And so, yeah.
I can see that. You know, you'd think it's kind of, you know, it's an asset. You're mm-hmm. selling an asset,
mm-hmm.
right? But it's an asset that, depending on the buyer mm-hmm. and what they want to do with it,
mm-hmm.
that changes everything. You know, whereas a house, someone's just going to live in it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Think? Absolutely. Yeah. You know, where's the buyer? What kind of buyers are they? Yeah, you know, what are they going to do with the house? it's a much longer process than, mm-hmm. you know, than you would think it is sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. I like this one. What role does legacy play when you're talking through goals and outcomes with the seller?
Mm. It can play a really big role. It's all about what, you know, what that owner is seeking. So, like, I know I worked on one M&A deal in the managed care space, and essentially the seller cared about the price at which the business was sold, but it was super important, but social issues or his legacy was also extremely important. Mm. What mm-hmm. was going to happen to the employees
right,
of his business post the transaction? That mattered a great deal. And I've seen that in other spaces, seen in medical devices as well. And when you have a business that bears the business, the family name, you know, it's a brand name business in some way, that can matter a tremendous amount because the terms may stipulate what happens to use of that name going forward, and that's a part of the owner's legacy.
Yes.
And so that can matter a ton.
For sure. When it comes to, you know, those business owners who really care what happens to the employees,
mm-hmm.
how in the Hades do you include that in the contract to where you feel comfortable? Or is it more a question of, do I trust this partner to buy this business?
So it's really having it properly documented, and you know, I'm not a lawyer. I'm going to start at a lane, but you definitely want that all detailed in the sell and purchase agreement, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it is also trusting that buyer, but you know, you want to trust, but also verify. So to the extent verify means being able to look at the history of transactions by that buyer and what have they done in those prior situations, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. if they have a track record of, you know, doing what they say they're going to do, then you can trust, and because they have credibility,
right,
that you can trust they're going to do what they said they're going to do. So,
okay.
Yeah.
All right. Awesome. Anything we haven't covered that you feel super passionate about and you want to talk about?
No, not on my end. I feel like you covered.
We covered a lot of ground. It was good. It was good. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
For joining
thank you. It was good to be here. It was good
game.
To chat with you.
Yes.
You're always good to talk.
Oh, thank you. I enjoy chatting with you too. Thank you so much for joining us. We hope you enjoyed the chat too, and we hope you join us next time on M&A Access.
These kinds of conversations are happening all the time. We'd love for you to join in, whether it's through our monthly webinars, our biannual conferences, or our SEMA certification, and then we have our chapter events across the nation all year round. You can find out more at amaaonline.com. Until then, see you next time.